due diligence. You might recall, and Jerry's handing out the checklist, and raise your hand if you don't have it. You might recall last week we started off with five examples, basically to indicate to you how important this topic was. And we'll finish with the, kind of those up at the end. So once you know what the problems are, then we started the solutions. And the first part of the solution is gathering the information, because it's hard to do planning and it's hard to know to be good stewards if you don't know what you're being good stewards over. So the first thing was gather information to be able to help you understand what to do. And then we talked a little bit about insurance solutions and talked about various types of insurance that you could probably maintain, again, to help protect things. We finished up with umbrella insurance. That was kind of right at the very end of the session, that's pretty reasonably priced. And, you know, the way the lawyers can be, with attorney's fees, you can eat into $300,000, which is most of what your general liability insurance is going to be. You can eat into that pretty quickly. And so they've got umbrella policies out there, $1 million, $2 million, that are relatively inexpensive. That's a little outside of my area, so you can talk to Joey or some of the other guys who know more about insurance than I do. But I did want to put that on the table for you, that you're thinking about those types of things. Questions, comments, thoughts from last week before we get into starting the actual nuts and bolts of kind of the various types of solutions? Yeah, Joe. That was more aid in attendance, which is actually a military benefit.
Okay.
So that was one that I didn't know about. If you're active military, or if you were in the military, and my dad was in the Korean War, for example, he didn't serve in Korea. He actually was in the Skies troops in Austria. But because he served in the Korean War, he's eligible for about $1,300 a month through aid in attendance through the Veterans Administration. Mm-hmm. Laura. Oh, okay. Extra help. Okay. Okay. Great. Appreciate that. I didn't know about that one. Good. Okay. Let's turn to healthcare. This applies in a wide variety of times. I'm going to cite basically four things that you can do. I'm going to recommend two of them, because the other two in past times have been relatively commonly used, but there's now some new and better alternatives. The first thing that we've got is a living will. A lot of you have heard about living wills. I'm going to talk about living trusts later, and living wills and living trusts are different things. But in Missouri, a living will is limited to death-delaying procedures. So, for example, it doesn't apply to feeding tubes and liquids, and it only applies in terminal conditions. So it has pretty limited use. Then there's something else called an advance directive, and in an advance directive, directions can go beyond a living will, include withholding medications and the artificial nutrition and hydration. But those only apply while a patient is competent. Once a patient is incapacitated, an advance directive without more is no longer effective. So both of those two aren't very useful. The third one is the useful one. It's called a durable power of attorney for healthcare combined with advance directive. And that's what my view is everybody needs. An advance directive continues in effect after the patient is incapacitated, with an agent designated by the patient making the decisions in place of the patient. It authorizes your attorney, in fact, to make healthcare decisions for you in the event you're unable to do so by reason of incapacity. Now, not surprisingly, that's a very important job, and so you're going to really want to make sure you understand who that is. And so a lot of thought goes by as to who that is, but when you have those in place, in those situations, it makes things much nicer. It's called durable because there's a couple of additional steps, including a notarization and some wording that's actually in the power of attorney itself that makes it durable and therefore survives when a person becomes incapacitated. I've got a cite to the Missouri Bar Form, which is on the website, and you don't need an attorney to prepare a durable power of attorney to you, even though it's called power of attorney. But the Missouri Bar website, that MissouriLawyerHelp.org, that's got a really good standard durable power of attorney. You fill out there's some questions, some optional things. You fill those out, you sign it, you have it notarized, and you're all set to go. That becomes very relevant for kids over 18, because once your child turns 18, as a parent, you no longer have any say-so about their medical care decisions. We ran into that with Kirsten. She's in school in Nashville and came down sick, and we wanted to talk to the doctors about it, and we didn't have a power of attorney. And you know the old saying about the shoemaker whose kids don't have shoes, a lawyer's daughter didn't have a power of attorney. She now has a power of attorney. So sometimes you don't think about that when your children turn 18, that suddenly you don't have any say-so in this kind of area. So if your children are approaching that age, get one of these in place. It can solve a whole lot of problems. Which raises the other one that I've got listed, is the privacy release form, because that allows you to make medical decisions for them, but it doesn't go so far. In some instances, doctors are a little touchy on this as to whether or not they'll talk to you even if you have the power of attorney in place. But you can get a privacy release form, and this would give your child, gives you permission to talk to the doctors. The doctor's offices all have them. You get them, you sign them, and you have those with each doctor's office, and then you're in good shape. Yeah?
On the durable power of attorney for children when they turn 18, does that have to be signed after they turn 18, or do they sign it before they turn 18?
I actually don't know that. I would think they could sign it before they're 18. Most people just don't get around to it until it's many months after that, and they say, oh, man, I need to get one of those. I'm not sure on that. I've actually never looked at it. But I would think they would probably be able to, especially with the notary. Yeah, Joe.
Jim, if you found yourself in a situation where you had one of the documents that was enforced, you didn't have a copy and you needed it, would they accept an electronic version of the copy so that you put it out on the cloud somewhere and you can download it where you're at? Would they take that?
Yeah, they will. Matter of fact, with my mom, for example, like Caterpillar Tractor, where my dad worked, I have my mom's power of attorney, and that's all they wanted me to do is just scan it in and email it to them. So, yeah, that's become the pretty common way of doing it, is all of that's electronic. About the only things that they won't accept electronic anymore with the new statutes are things that need a raised seal on them. If they need original birth certificate, I mentioned the original military documents, sometimes you'll need those, but virtually everything else, electronic is just fine. There's a new federal act that basically says anything you can do on paper, you can do electronically. So with your durable power of attorney, and Gerald's point is well taken, sometimes in the past what people would do is they get their signed documents, and to keep them safe, they'd put them in the safe deposit box at the bank. Well, in the stroke situation that I raised last week, it's 3 a.m, and a stroke occurs, and you need that power of attorney, most of your banks aren't going to let you in at 3 o'clock in the morning to go get your power of attorney. So keep copies of those around. If you've got them electronic, that's even better. But make sure you know where those are at. Having them sitting in your safe deposit box will be helpful if the situation arises during the day, but it just is kind of the way it is those things very seldom occur during the day. I don't know why that is. But they happen at inopportune times. So as long as you've got it either in your black box that I talked about last week, you've got them in your black box at home, or you've got them electronically, then you're in good shape. So the two things for healthcare that I recommend is the durable power of attorney and then the privacy release forms at the various doctors. And then for spouses, both of those, and if you've got them for your kids over 18, between those types of things, you're going to be pretty well protected in healthcare decision making. Questions, thoughts? Anybody had any experiences or anything that they want to raise with that, or anything that I left out?
Yeah,
Okay, now let's talk about decision making. And this decision making is on non-healthcare matters. So we talked about a durable power of attorney for healthcare decisions. There's another durable power of attorney that you should have. That's the durable power of attorney for financial matters. And that's different than the power of attorney that we talked about in paragraph C. This is you allow somebody else to make decisions financially for you. And we'll talk about other ways with signing on checks and all that sort of stuff. We'll talk about that later. But the questions you need to ask is, who should be named the power of attorney? What power should that power agent have? Because the power of attorney is not required by statute to have any particular powers. You can make those as broad or as narrow as you want to. This next one is really important, and that's when is it effective? And there's two different times that people make these effective. You can either make them effective from day one, and no matter what your shape is, your mental state or whatever, that power of attorney, that agent, can exercise those powers on your behalf. As you can imagine, that's got its advantages and its disadvantages. The other time it can kick in is incapacity. And some of the power of attorneys for financial matters that you'll see says, I have to be determined to be incompetent by at least two doctors before that power of attorney will kick in. That's a pain in the neck. But the problem is, and it can be expensive because you've got to find two doctors and go through that process. So that's difficult. But the flip side is, if you've given somebody your power of attorney that's good at all points in time, if there becomes a disagreement between the two of you and somebody's got your power of attorney to go do kind of whatever they want to, risky situation. So you've got to balance those two competing factors as to which way you're going to do it. Debbie and mine are both all the time. So if Debbie ever gets mad at me, I'm in deep trouble. With my mom's, I've got it all the time because I didn't want to have to put her through having two doctors declare her incompetent. That's a pretty big psychological deal for particularly an elderly person that two doctors say you're incompetent. Otherwise, we just have it in place and I can do it. It's particularly good on bank accounts for children to help pay bills. You got to be a little careful with bank accounts because the standard way of doing it is just adding somebody to the bank account. That's kind of the standard way that most people do it. You add that person's name to the bank account. The risk there is when that person's name is on the bank account, they're a joint owner of that account. So let's say, just for example, Jerry and I are brothers, and I decide to put Jerry on my bank account. And so Jerry and I are both now the named people on the bank account. Jerry's creditors can now get to my bank account. So that's one of the differences where a power of attorney or a check signing authority comes into play much better than granting somebody to putting their actual name on the bank account. Most people don't think about that. It's just, I put my kid on my account to help pay my bills when I can't do it, and that's all they can do is just sign checks that I tell them to. Not the case. If you put them on the account as a joint account holder, their creditors can get access to your bank account. So just think about that when you're talking about how to do that. So it's a good way, this power of attorney, and having them just as a check signer and not actually be on the account, that works out pretty well. It's got to meet the statutory definition of durable, and again, it mainly involves a notary on there. So a durable power of attorney is good to do ahead of time. Some of you knew Debbie's grandmother. Well, her husband had got really bad dementia, and they hadn't done any of this stuff. The problem was he really couldn't make any decisions for himself, and she wasn't on a lot of the assets. We had to go in and get a conservator for him, a guardian at that point in time. Now, it helped at that point in time to have a grandson-in-law who was a lawyer, I could actually have my guys go in and do it, and it didn't cost her anything. Otherwise, it would be fairly expensive to get a conservator appointed. But the really bad thing was, and if you knew Jessie, you'll understand this story, is we had to have her come to the courthouse in downtown Kansas City and testify in front of a judge. And if you know Jessie, or if you knew Jessie, that was a pretty traumatic experience for her to come into the big courthouse, sit down, get into the witness chair, and the whole bit. So to the extent you can get this kind of stuff in place, you avoid the issues and the traumatic experiences of an older person having to go in and go through the process of having a conservator appointed for their spouse. That's kind of decision making as far as healthcare matters and financial matters. Dan. Yeah, your bank will be able to help you out on it. Is just say, I want this person to be able to sign checks on my account. And that does, you don't want them on the account, you just want the check signing on it. And the banks are pretty used to this, so they can help you out on that. Joe. I would, because, and again, you like to think you're invincible at that age, but particularly in that instance, if something happens to you, then it's what happens. And at that point in time, you're dealing with probate courts, and where things go are not always the way you think they would go. And so having that in place, if nothing else, just to pay the final bills and all of that, having these things taken care of, and particularly, you never know when a traffic accident is going to come in. And young person gets in a traffic wreck, becomes brain issues, and who takes care of that situation, paying hospital bills, collecting money, those kind of things, without a power of attorney, none of that can take place without going into the court. And I don't want to be the downer here, but those kind of things do happen. We see them in the press all the time. And so no matter what age you are, there's a possibility that those kind of things could happen. So, yeah, I would recommend them, anytime over 18, having those in place.
And just a quick follow-up. If I understood correctly, it's just a matter of downloading this form and going to a notary, which could be somebody at the bank or something like that. So there really is very minimal investment.
Yeah, actually, the website I cited was actually the medical decision. If you want also the power of attorney for financial matters, it's not on the MoBar website, but if you Google it and you want a power of attorney, they're all over the Internet. And there's really nothing fancy about them. So just pulling one off the Internet. I'm going to cite some other sources here in a little bit. But you can Google it. You can fill it in. And yeah, and my understanding, I was talking to Shane and a couple of other folks about getting notaries. And your bank, they tell me your bank will notarize things. We'll talk about wills in a minute where you need two signatures, two witnesses. And Shane's experience was at his bank, when he was there, not only would they notarize, but they'd just grab a couple of people, a couple of clerks from the lobby and actually do your witnesses for you too. So check with your bank before you do it. But my understanding is most of the banks will do that. Let's talk about family matters is next. And the example of who will take care of the kids that I cited is true. You got to be careful of that, because if both husband and wife passes away, who's going to take care of the kids? And what you could do, and the example that I gave is not so hypothetical. You have one side of the family who's fairly wealthy, not members of the church. You can fill in the blanks the way you want to. The other side of the family, relatively modest income, members of the church. You don't specify anything. It comes in front of a judge. Judges aren't often very religious. And put yourself in that judge's shoes. Where's those kids going to go? And so to the extent, especially when you want to get assurances as to who's going to raise your kids, at that point in time, doing a will where you build in who becomes the guardians for the kids, I think is really, really important. Now, just so you know, that's not binding on the court. The court actually does maintain some discretion, but at least from what I understand from the probate folks that I deal with, the courts are pretty respectful of things like that. So that would be a will, and within the will, you can name who your suggestion is for the guardian of your children. Now, what you can do is you can have the guardian of the children different than who's going to manage your money. So a lot of wills will have two trusts, in effect, that's set up in the wills. One is who's going to be the guardian for the kids, and one part is who's going to be responsible for the money. And oftentimes, those are two different things, and you've got that flexibility with the wills. But for young families, I think this is probably one of the most important things you're going to hear me say, is think about that, get it down in writing so that you avoid those issues. Because battles between grandparents are not very pleasant. And especially by definition, you're not going to be there. And that can create all sorts of situations. So really think about that. Property matters is where we go to next. Lifetime dealing with property matters. I talked about the durable power of attorney for financial matters, so we've already covered that. So remember, you need two powers of attorneys, one for health care, one for financial matters. Now what happens on death? If you don't do anything, it's called intestate, and that's all probate. And under Missouri law, and I cited it last week, and Rita and I were talking about it a little bit, under Missouri law, if you don't say anything else, your spouse gets $20,000 and then half of what's left, and your kids split the rest, no matter what age they are. So if you, for example, a husband wants to manage the household, and so everything's in your name, nothing's in your wife's name, you die without a will, and let's say you've got kids 16 and 18, and you've got a $100,000 estate, your wife gets the first $20,000, and then she gets half of what's left, so she gets another $40,000, and your kids split the rest. It doesn't go to your spouse. So that tells me it's really important to get property situations as to where the property goes, get that under control. Because if you talk to 9 out of 10 Missourians and told them without a will and without joint properties and some things I'm about to talk about, that's the way property would go. People would look at you like you were nuts. But that's the way the law is in Missouri. So it's real important to actually take care of that. There are some exempt properties, the family Bibles, books, clothing, household appliances, furniture, one car, that kind of stuff. So next is probate. Probate is court-supervised administration of the estate, paying debts, transferring property. It's very complicated. It's very expensive. You have an executor appointed. Even if you have a will, the will still has to go through probate, but if you've got a will, it's certainly much easier. The size of the estate will determine the complexity. In Missouri, it's $40,000 and under are simplified. The timing, the shortest is 6 months and 10 days up to many, many years. So, again, if you have to take things through probate, it's very difficult and it's very time-consuming and expensive. So to me, the goal is, and this is the important part of what I'm dealing with tonight, other than the deals with the family matters, is you try to minimize probate. And now under Missouri law, we have done all sorts of new statutes and new ways of distributing assets. It used to be a situation, and I'll finish up with living trust. That used to be the way you do it. You get a trust, you transfer your assets into the trust, and that took care of everything. The problem was you get this trust done, and it's a real fancy trust, and then you forget to transfer things into the trust. So Missouri law now has all sorts of ways where you can transfer property without going through probate. For example, number one is joint property. A lot of husbands and wives will have their property, joint property, so it's joint tenants with right of survivorship, and then it goes, when one spouse dies, it goes to the other. And that's great when you've got two spouses. Question is, what happens then when one spouse dies and you've got one spouse left? So joint property is often a way that will do it. You can sometimes do that with bank accounts. I talked about that there's a risk if you do that. with non-husband-wife situation. There's the risk of the creditors of the other person. Missouri with husbands and wife, we've got something called tenancy by the entirety, and it only deals with husbands and wives where the creditor of one cannot get to the assets that you hold in joint tenancy. That's really important in my business and any professions. I think it's really important. So if I happen to commit malpractice and I get sued for a whole bunch of money and all of our assets with WME are all in tenancy by the entirety, which they are, a creditor of just mine cannot get to our joint assets. So if you're in a situation where a spouse can have some liability out of the profession, Jerry cuts somebody ears off. Not that he'd ever do that, but with things, if things are, we're in just Jerry's name, the person who sues Jerry can get to everything. If it's in joint with Jerry and Denise, the creditor of just Jerry can't get to the assets. Now, if it's a creditor of both of you, then they can get to those assets. But that's one of the beauties. Missouri is one of the few states that have that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For protection, that's why I incorporated. Mm-hmm.
It does, assuming you've got your hair tailor's ink stock in both of your names. I don't know what the. I think it's.
Well,
yeah,
no,
but it does. That's one of the reasons why people incorporate. So, but the kicker is with a sole proprietorship from a liability standpoint, you could actually get around it by just putting all the assets in tenancy by the entirety and get you around it also. Yeah, good point. Corporations and LLCs are pretty standard ways of doing that too. Let's talk about other ways for other assets. We've got pay-on-death designation, and that's an automatic transfer on death upon presentation of a death certificate. You can do that with bank accounts. You can do it with certificate of deposit. It's sometimes called transfer on death designation, so a TOD. A TOD and a POD are the same thing. You can do it for stocks and bonds. For example, with us, now that Kirsten's over 18, our stock accounts, we have a POD so that it automatically goes to Kirsten. My mom on her account has a transfer on death on her stock accounts where it goes 50% to me and 50% to my sister. So you've got stocks and bonds, brokerage accounts. Here's one that's relatively new. You can do it on your house, and that you didn't used to be able to do. You can file in the Recorder of Deeds a separate transfer on death deed, and upon your death, your property, your house will go to whoever you say in the transfer on death. So with my parents, before we sold the house, we had a transfer on death that upon my parents' death, a 50% undivided interest went to my sister and a 50% undivided interest went to me. It wasn't effective until death, and the beauty from the person who drafts the TO or prepares the TOD, it's revocable whenever you want to. So let's say husband and wife have three kids. They do a TOD on the house for all three kids, and one kid they decide they really don't want anymore. You could revoke the old one and put one to just the two kids, and if they don't like any of the kids, they could go ahead and revoke it and give it to somebody else. So it's completely revocable until your death, and then it becomes effective on your death. Besides POD and TOD, you can do beneficiary designations. Most of you are familiar with that. Your life insurance policies, you designate who the beneficiary is. Your 401ks, IRAs, pension plans, other retirement accounts, all of those allow you to designate beneficiaries upon your death. So a payment on death, transfer on death, and beneficiaries all kind of do the same things. Joe.
Most of the things you talked about there can be equally divided. Mm-hmm.
Actually, it gives you an interest in the property. You know, I talked about joint tenancy. This makes it tenancy in common. And basically what it means is each person, let's say there's two, each person owns a 50% undivided interest in the property. So, for example, if you're renting it, each of you get 50% of the profits. And if you're one of the 50% owners and you die, you can will that or give that to your descendants. So, for example, if Melinda and Randy and Sam all have one-third, one-third, one-third. Sam passes away, he could give his one-third to his kids, and Melinda and Randy would still own the other, each own the other one-third. So it gives you a lot of flexibility on things that you can do on that. The other thing that you can do, and remember I told the blue lamp story. Under most wills, yeah, go ahead, Tim. Yeah, you do. Yeah, the difference, the any debt on the property would go as a part of it. Yeah, again. No, it's all personal. It's you do it to whoever you want to. You prepare it, and there's some pretty good sources on the internet for it. You do it, you file it with the recorder of deeds, and it's done. Nobody else has to know, and it's not going to be a violation of your mortgages to be able to do that. The other thing that I'll finish up on property is, remember I told the story about the blue lamp, and I used some hypothetical names, which is really my uncle and my aunt. And they really did get into that issue. You, as a part of your will or separately, you can actually do a piece of paper that says, I want these things to go to these people, and you lay it out. If it's part of your will, the court will actually enforce it. If it's not part of your will and you just do it, most courts are going to enforce it anyway if there becomes a dispute. But the odds are pretty good. You minimize the risk of a dispute if you do it. Some people find it fairly therapeutic. You know, you get older and you're looking at your stuff, and you can sit down with a grandchild and say, grandchild, I'd like to have you to have this. And you actually write it down. Because if you don't write it down, it's kind of, oftentimes it's whoever shows up at the house first takes what they want. And it just kind of happens that way. But if you've got the list written out as to who gets what, and people know about that, it's going to normally be respected. If it's incorporated in your will, then it's actually going to be enforceable by the court. So that's kind of the other area of dispute. But really, when you think about it, what we've been talking about is you've got some property can be in joint property. You got your bank accounts. You can either do power of attorney, joint, or TOD or POD. You got your bank accounts. You got your certificates of deposit. You got your stocks and bonds. You got your brokerage accounts. You've got your real estate. You can do TOD on cars these days because on the car we just bought, we actually have it done there. When you think about the extent of your assets, that's pretty much all. And then you can do all these others on the property list. That's kind of pretty much most people's assets. And so as a result, if you follow that and you do these things, you can still do a pour over a will of some type, but the vast majority of your assets are taken care of. And I will guarantee you, from talking to many, many people who have dealt with parents' estates, if these things are all taken care of, your job as the child, no matter what age you are, makes it a whole lot easier than having to try to figure out what's going on. And so when you've got all that stuff set up, it really goes much smoother. Randy. One thing, just following up on that, you got to be a little careful of that. You can do a TOD on an LLC interest too. Matter of fact, I just did one. We've got an investment fund that actually I'm a member of, and as a part of the estate planning, we've done transfer on death on your LLC interest. So sometimes your LLC agreement will cover it. But when there's and if it's a sole member, it's pretty easy to do. But if you've got multiple people, you just agree on yourselves what's going to happen in that situation. Sometimes your LLC agreement says that upon your death, the other people have the right to buy you out. So it kind of depends on what your LLC agreement says. But if it doesn't have any restrictions on transfer on death, you can do a transfer on death. There's a Missouri statute that deals with it, and it says pursuant to section such and such, upon my death, the LLC interest goes to this person. You normally will have the managers of the LLC sign it, and then it will automatically transfer the LLC interest. I'm glad you raised that, because I had actually talked about stocks, but I forgot about LLC interest. Yeah. Good question. It goes to various family members, and it goes back, and there's actually a distribution chart as to where it goes. In that kind of situation, it will go to, I think, parents, and if there's no parents, it goes to siblings, and if there's no siblings, it starts going to cousins, and so it's just a whole big chain, and it depends on certain relationships, so it gets really complicated, which is a good point that really highlights why you need to do something. You know, you can even, if you don't want it to go to anybody, you can always designate a charity. And that's actually a point that's worth raising is there's a lot of community foundations and those kind of things. I was on the board of Truman Heartland Community Foundation, and so they'll help you if you have a charitable inclination. They have all sorts of options that if you don't want it to go to any of your family members, they can help you do it with the various charities. Steve.
I'm just going to point out that, you know, you talked about the importance of all these things, looking out for your kids. It's equally important to really consider who is going to be your power of attorney and the executor.
Yep.
I know of instances where the power of attorney and financial manager is also the executor of the estate.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. And you got different fiduciary duties. Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes it's better to do non-family members, who people kind of on the outside and no real vested interest because they're not going to get any of the estate. Yeah, appreciate that. Let me finish up with a couple of things. First of all, are lawyers needed for all these documents? The lawyer in me says, of course. And there's a lot of really good estate planning lawyers in Eastern Jackson County. One that I've talked to a few of you about that I actually know also, his name is Aaron Love. He's out in Eastern Jack, has done the estate plans for some people. Really good guy, really knows what he's doing, very reasonably priced. There's a lot of others who could do it, but that's his is the name that I know of. There's also some good, the non-lawyer in me says, there are also some pretty good online resources. Now, my disclaimer is I've never used them. I've not officially researched them. But LegalZoom.com actually is a client of ours. And I went on their website to kind of take a look at the documents. They're relatively inexpensive. They're easy forms. There's some questions that you answer. It fills in the document for you. There's also a website called Nolo, N-O-L-O.com, and buildawill.com. And again, I haven't used them, but I went on the websites and looked at them, and they seem pretty good as far as basic type things. The biggest issue with those is execution of the documents. To make a will, a self-proving will, as it's called, to make sure it meets all the testimony, it's got to be signed, it's got to be notarized, and then you have to have two witnesses who are non-family members and who are not taking anything under the will. Sometimes it's worth going to the lawyer because the lawyer's got the notaries and the witnesses in his or her offices. But again, I was talking to Shane afterwards and I think Blake, who indicated that, you know, that some of the banks will do that. So if you've done an online check with your bank, you may be able to go ahead and do it. In short, what I'll say is a lawyer is the best, but an online is better than doing nothing at all. and they're relatively inexpensive. I think the one that I looked at on LegalZoom was $150 for the will. The trust is going to be a little more expensive, but if you do the PODs and TODs and all that, you really don't need much. I'll finish up with the state tax. In past years, the state tax was a big concern. That was the vast majority of our estate planning work, is people were trying to avoid estate taxes because there was an exemption amount, and if your estate was above the exemption amount, the amount above the exemption amount was taxed at 40%. And that's a pretty huge number. You know, you think you've saved up to plan for your kids, and now the government's taking 40% of it. Because of the tax bill that went in place in 2018, that exemption now is up to $11.8 million. As a result, the vast majority of Americans are now no longer subject to estate tax. So it's more the things that we've covered that are now important, and not so much estate planning purposes. I'll finish up with living trusts because a lot of you have heard about those. Living trusts are a good way to do things. You set up a trust. You've got a trustee. During your lifetime, you put the assets in the trust, and you manage it during your lifetime. And when you're upon your death, it automatically kicks in. With all POD, TOD, and everything you can do now, there's really not a whole lot of usage left for those kind of trusts. People still have them, and they ought to keep them because you've already gone through the work. But for the vast majority of Americans now, with the way the estate tax works and all these additional new laws, you can accomplish about 95-96% of what you can do with the living trust without doing the living trust. They're normally going to be a 40 or 50 page document. They're going to be fairly expensive. You can make your choice on them, but with all these other new things, you minimize your risk and can get the vast majority of things accomplished. Questions, thoughts before I wrap up? Well, remember our examples. There's a reason why we do these kind of things. We've got things like the lamp. We've got things like who's going to take care of mom. We've got things like who's going to take care of the kids. These aren't pleasant things to think about, but it's even worse if you don't think about them and the people who survive you have to deal with it. I'll leave that with you. Thank you very much.